Okay, well, what I want to talk about today is definitely a work in progress, and there were some surprises, at least it was surprising to me, and so I'm just going to be showing you some preliminary results, but first I'm going to give you a little bit of a review. So this is some work that's been done in collaboration with Asley Sudbo, who's visiting Caltech for a year, and my student, Chunko Chung. And it goes back to, well, it seems like a long time ago, some work that I did on my thesis, but I'm going to be returning to. Those of you who went to the conference know that these staggered flux phases still seem to have some life in them. And the Laughlin group and also Patrick Lee have been talking about them. So I thought it would be good to try to take a second look at them and see if there's any hope that there are these T-breaking orbital currents. So I want to review for you quickly these this flux phase, and then I'm going to go through this fairly quickly, but I want to discuss a method that I'm going to be using to study the TJ ladder, which is going to be the simplest sort of system that we can hope to have a flux phase on. And then I'll apply this method to, well, I'll hope to convince you that this method's very reliable and very controlled and get nice results. And then I'm going to apply it to a simple Wurm problem, the type binding ladder, and then finally the TJ ladder, and then try to answer these questions about whether there can be spontaneous time reversal breaking in the ground state of these systems, or whether there's just some tendency towards quasi-long-range order. I think the answer, let me just tell you right away, this second question is yes, that there certainly is a tendency towards long-range order, and Patrick Lee has been emphasizing this, and but whether there's long-range, true long-range order remains to be answered definitively. Okay, so we all know what the TJ model is, but let me just remind you about one particular mean field solution of this, which is justified if we just do mathematically a large N theory of this problem, which is to say generalize the two species of spins to N such species and imagine we're allowed to take the limit N goes to infinity. And the basic point is that the spin-spin Heisenberg exchange can be decomposed by Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, and one gets these mean fields that live on the bonds of the lattice, this chi field is closely related at half filling to the decomposition. This is a decomposition in the particle hole channel. It's closely related to a decomposition in the particle-particle channel with the so-called delta mean fields. There's an SU2 symmetry right at half filling that shows that these two mean field theories are equivalent. But away from half filling, they describe two different things. And this theory, this particular decomposition, doesn't have superconductivity in its mean field description, but it does have real orbital currents, if you, and the question is whether this description survives down to the physical case of n equals 2. So let me just give you some justification for this flux phase that is actually due to Dan Rockshard's very simple way of seeing that in this mean field theory that a flux wants to turn on. So here we have our square lattice, and remember we have these mean fields that live on the bonds of the lattice, and we wanted to find out what's the optimal configuration of those mean fields that minimizes the free energy of the system. So the simplest possible piece of this lattice that could have that shows all the features we want is just to look at the four side problem. So let's think about electrons in a tight binding model on four sides. The dispersion will be just the inverted cosine curve. And so if we didn't have any magnetic flux penetrating through this lattice, if we wanted to half fill the system in lowest energy state, what we would do is we put one fermion down here at k equals 0, and then we would have a choice between pi over 2 or minus pi over 2 to put our second fermion. So that would be for half filling, if we were talking about two species of spins, spin up and spin down, we'd do this separately for both the up and down spins. So now, if we're allowed to let these chi fields take on imaginary or complex expectation values, then we see that if we adjust the flux to be pi going through this black end, that actually lowers the energy further because that shifts the allowed momenta that we can fill, and now we can fill states at plus or minus pi over 4, and the energy for filling these two states is lower than the energy for filling these two states. So the system wants to spontaneously develop a flux in this mean field description. Now, it looks like we've broken translational symmetry at half filling. Flux wants to be pi or minus pi, but of course minus pi is equivalent to pi. So this is sort of a gauge artifact, and in fact, the unit cell, the unit cell has one side. So if we go beyond just a single plaquette, we can think about the energetics of this flux phase. And what's happening here at half filling is that if we have a tight binding model, for example, with no, that would be the description of a no flux state. Of course, at half filling, we would fill all the states in the interior of this square. And so we have this strong nesting instability at pi-pi. But we can get rid of that nesting stability. We turn on the flux because then the dispersion ends up having a gap everywhere along the Fermi surface except at these four discrete points. So what we're doing is we're pushing all the states that were right here at zero energy, at the Fermi energy, we're pushing them down in energy. And we only have these 4 points where the energy is non-zero, where the gap to create an excitation is non-zero.
Has anybody looked at these flux phase solutions when you turn on and on these prime terms and that kind of thing?
Yes.
What happens in those cases? Does it destabilize it?
Well, it exists over some finite region. I have some, I'll show you some slides. But yeah, because it lifts the nesting instability, it tends to weaken the tendency to form flux. But it still exists over some non-zero region. It's not instantaneously eliminated. All right, so here's just the quasi-particle dispersion for this flux phase. It's the square root, instead of just the sum of two cosines, as it would be in the absence of the flux, it's now the square root of these two cosine squares, which only has isolated zeros at the nodal points. Then the nesting instability is removed, but because the unit cell remains, only has one site, this is sort of a new way of removing the nesting instability. We're used to removing nesting instability by forming charge density waves or spin density waves. But here, and that would enlarge the unit cell. Here, effectively, the unit cell hasn't been enlarged, and yet there's a gap everywhere except at these discrete points. So implicit to all of this is this U1 symmetry, which I haven't really emphasized. It's just simply reflecting the local constraint that we have exactly one particle per site. So since we have a local conservation law, we have this local U1 symmetry. Now, in some sense, the flux really is pi in these systems. If we just take the 2x2 or 4x4 Heisenberg antiferromagnet and calculate the expectation value of the flux operator, which is simply the product of four of these mean fields going around, or four of these fields going around the plaquette, then this thing is negative, and that's what you would expect for a pi flux. Now, this isn't really a broken symmetry. This is just some sort of quantitative evidence that perhaps this state isn't so far from reality. Well, if you use the equations of motion, you can express that operator as a bunch of expectation value. The expectation value of that operator is a bunch of spin-spin correlations. Some the most complicated of which would involve four spins on each of the corners of the plaquette. So one substitutes in, and then because that operator preserves the subspace where you have one particle per site, then this thing translates into, we can show it translates into this.
It almost looks like the limit.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's not quite that, the same thing.
Right, it's going to be related to the ring exchange. Also, there's some three spin terms.
High flux, that's what a sign is negative.
Okay. There's some three spin terms which are zero because there's no time reversal frame.
This is only for half filling or
that's right.
Away from half filling?
This is all.
It doesn't hold on away. Is there a formula for away from
half filling? Yeah, we're coming to that. Let me just say one more thing about half-filling, which is, of course, well, this state does not break spin rotational variance. It doesn't have Nail order, so on the face of it, it's not a good description of what we know is the Nail ordered Heisenberg any ferromagnet. But I would like to argue that it's not so far away from that. So we can do a variational problem where we take this flux state, which of course doesn't, we don't have only enforced a single occupancy constraint on average. We'll apply the Gusswald projection operator to enforce it strictly on each side, and then do this as a variational wave function. And the energetics argue for the idea that this might have something that isn't so far from the anti-ferromagnet. If we take the no-flux state and ask what its expectation value of its energy is on a bond, it's minus 0.267 times J. If we take, we could add some Nail order to this, the optimal amount of Nail order, we would do that by adding basically a staggered chemical potential that favors up spins on one sublattice and down on the other, and then adjust M as our one variational parameter. And that does quite a bit better. Here's the exact, essentially exact result from quantum Monte Carlo on a, I guess, a 32 by 32 site system. If we start off with a flux phase, we do much better. And then if we add Nail order, then we get pretty close to the exact energy with just one variational parameter. Yes?
So this did put the flux order and the Nail order. Imagine that that's actually not a conventional antiferromagnet, but rather it's an antiferromagnet that has spinons in its control.
Right, but the spinons are gapped. Yes. So they're basically gapped by this scale down.
Okay.
So, yeah, if you look at the spin structure function, it differs from just the simplest sort of state, or I guess, say, this state. There's some deep quantitative deep differences in the high or medium energy physics compared to, say, this state. And
but it's really a qualitative issue.
Yeah.
I mean, either the spinons are in the spectrum or they're not.
Right.
The fact that they're at finite energy is not really, that's relevant to low energy physics, but it's not relevant to the issue of fractionalization.
Yeah.
For instance, that state without one state is going to be, this is larger than this.
And that's AF star.
But the spin wave has much lower energy than the spinons.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I know it's just the reverse, as you might.
If I have no order, I typically have a spinency wave gap.
I know, but it's question what the excitations above the gap are.
No, but the question is, in the flux phase state, I have notable points, right?
Sure.
So it seems like if I open up a full spinency wave gap, I lower the free energy when I did that, right?
Right.
Sure.
They become gaps.
So what if I took a null state and simply projected it, rather than going through this flux?
You'll have a much higher energy.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. I mean, that's basically what this state is with no flux, but it's real.
Just from this, it may appear that the state that which has Nail order and which has spinons in its spectrum apparently has some, just the best energy to keep.
That's right. That's the state.
So that can be raised.
Right.
No, but after the projection, how do we even know there's a spinon?
Well,
we have to look at the ground state in general.
Exactly, that's what the ground state is.
Okay, I don't want to spend too much time on the half filled case because I want to look really for true orbital currents, which of course require going away from half filling so that we have some charge, possibility of charge circulating. All right, so if we continue with our mean field description, and now we dope away from half-filling using the Slade boson approach, where basically we normalizes the hopping amplitude T by the doping. And the flux goes away continuously from pi. And now we really do have a Rogan symmetry because minus phi is not the same as phi unless phi is equal to pi. And so the unit cell has been doubled, and there are real currents and real magnetic fields that are circulating. We looked at this a long time ago, almost 10 years ago, in the hopes that we could there could be an experimental test of this. And in fact, there were some early muon experiments looking for the possibility of some small circulating fields. But at the time, the issue was somewhat murky because of this spin blast phase. So this is the sort of thing that Bob Laughlin and Chen Nayak and Sudeep Chakravarti and Kirk Moore have been raising again. So I don't want to dwell on the phenomenology too much, but let me just show you what happens to the dispersion. As we go away from half filling, then two things happen. Of course, we're going to be doping away from the nodal points, but also as the flux changes away from pi, then these cones distort into these squished cones. And so we would expect to have some hole pockets in the system. This is energy contour plot. So white is zero energy, and these are very increasingly negative quasi-particle energies.
These are the dispersion for the spinelons, I guess. Is that right?
Well, yes. I mean, now, so the bosons, I Bose condensed the bosons, the holes. The holons are all, we're giving them to non-zero expectation value, and this is the dispersion for the spinons, yes.
It's a scintillating
phase. Since the order parameter is the chi order parameter, it's not in the particle channel, it's not superconducting.
Spinons aren't paired.
Right.
And theta is related to phi.
That's right, yeah. It's by a kind of complicated formula because the hopping amplitude is involved and so on.
The whole ones are around zero.
Yes.
So this would be a Fermi
nucleus. These are electron-like quasi-particles.
Right.
Is what you're thinking, right?
Right. I mean, you have some small Fermi surface here, and the gauge symmetry has been broken by getting a non-zero expectation value to the boson operators. The gauge fluctuations presumably aren't so large. So we would expect to have a long quasi-particle lifetime.
Yeah, I mean, the electron tactile function is sharp,
right? I mean, I assume. You can imagine to have a place where bosons are not condensed, then what will be
Then, well,
I
better talk to Patrick about that.
I don't even know why I think about that right now.
I suppose.
It's just smeared out, but I don't think the position is going to change.
Completely destroyed, yeah. All right, so what's the effect of T prime on this? Well, it distorts the shape of these things. If I include a negative T prime and some sort of reasonable parameters, then if I hold out and look at this version, and something like this, it's going to make them squatter or something. And if I add electron dope, then you could see there's some differences in the shape here with the contours.
You guys talk about Luttinger's theorem all the time. Do you sort of satisfy Luttinger's theorem?
yes, I guess so. Because we doubled the unit cell, then it's a lot like a band insulator or whatever. Right? So if you have an even number of electrons per site, then the Fermi surface would be obliterated. Unless you build away from that, and that's what we're doing now. So now you have these tiny hole pockets. Okay, so that was a quick review of the flux phase. So now I want to talk about the method that I want to apply towards understanding the system, which is using the density matrix renormalization group combined with finite size scaling. So the idea here is to try to utilize the fact that the density matrix renormalization group, which I'll explain in a moment, works best on chains with open boundary conditions. So instead of viewing this as an obstacle, where we often like to have periodic boundary conditions, I'd like to use those open boundary conditions to my advantage. So I want to illustrate this with the case of a spin one-half Heisenberg antiferromagnet, for example. And so let's think about what happens as we go from a four-site problem to a six-site to an eight-site and approach the thermodynamic limit by growing the chain, increasing its size systematically two sites at a time. So up here I've drawn a sequence of solid bonds and dotted bonds, and what that's supposed to indicate is some modulation in the strength of the nearest neighbor spin-spin correlation function, SI dot SI plus 1. So you can think of this almost as a molecule, and what this open boundary condition wants to do is it wants to, it breaks the translational symmetry, obviously, and that induces some degree of dimerization in the interior of that chain. So, in particular, the system wants to minimize its energy by sort of maximizing the number of singlet bonds. So the way that it does that is that these outer flanking bonds, it tries to enhance the singlet correlations. And that induces this alternating pattern if we just focus on the central bond of weak, strong correlations between the neighboring spins. Now, of course, as the chain gets larger and larger, assuming it's not in a dimerized phase, the modulation in that strength will decay, and in the case of the spin one half Heisenberg system, it will decay as a power law because this is a gapless system that's quantum critical. We can do the same thing by applying a magnetic field at the ends of the chain, and we'll just clamp the spins up in this this end and down in that spin, down at that end. That will induce some magnetization in the interior of the chain. And as the chain grows, if we monitor the strength of the moment in the interior, it will certainly decrease by the Mervyn-Wagner theorem. We preserve the rotational symmetry of the system, there can't be any long-range magnetic order in one dimension. That will decay, and it will decay either exponentially or as a power law, depending on, again, whether we're in a massive phase or a massless phase. So this idea meshes well with the DMRG algorithm, which, as I just say, works for, for open systems. And in particular, it works well with the simplest variety of this DMRG algorithm, which is the so-called infinite size algorithm. Now, the first thing you should know about the DMRG algorithm is that all of these phrases up here are somewhat misleading. So first of all, the infinite size, we're going to be using this for finite size systems. That's for some historical reasons. Density matrix. Well, we're not really using the density matrix. We're using something called the reduced density matrix, which I'll explain in a moment. And RG renormalization group, it's not really a renormalization group. What it is it's a systematic variational method, which we can make increasingly accurate approximations to the true wave functions up to the limitations of our computer resources. So let me sketch for you how this algorithm works. So let's just think about, for concreteness, the spin one half Heisenberg gain for a magnet. So for that guy, the on-site Hilbert space dimension, which I'll call D, is equal to 2. So that's just spin up or down. So let's look at a chain that has 8 sites and ask what it would take to grow that to 10 sites. So this 8-site system, each site has a dimension 2. So the total dimension of the Hilbert space is going to be equal to d to the eighth power. So that's going to be equal to
256
for this system. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to cut this in half, and then we're going to add 2 more sites in the center and glue the 2 pieces back together so that we'll then have a chain that has 10 sites. So now the Hilbert space is increased to 1024. And let's just say, for the sake of argument, that that won't fit in our computer. Of course, this is a very simple system, and we usually go much further. So what we're going to do is we're going to cut this in half, and we're going to add another site on both halves of the system. So this block, which used to include 3 sites that are just off from the center, we're going to have to cram another site into it in order to, we have to move this site into this block in order to add 2 more sites in the center. So the total Hilbert space here, as I've shown it, is really m times d times e times m, because the way I group things, we'll just say that we have these 2 central sites, each of dimension D, and then we have the 2 peripheral blocks, each of dimension M. So in this case, M is going to be equal to 8, because we have these 3 sites. And let's say that we can't let M get any bigger than that. So now what we've done is we've tried to increase M to six, size 16, but we ran out of computer memory, so we're going to keep it at just 8. So how are we going to do that? And the answer is to use this reduced density matrix, which is to say that this whole chain is divided into two halves, the environment and the system. And when we cut it in half, what we'll do is we'll form a density matrix for each of the halves of the system. And that density matrix I can write as this, using, say, the ground state wave function. So I've represented the ground state wave function psi and as a thing with two indices. I labels the four sites over here, and I prime labels the four sites over here. So I and I prime run from 1 to 16, right? Because we have 8 states here and 2 there, so 16 possible states. So this psi is a 16 by 16 matrix, 16 by 16 is equal to 256. That's the total dimension of the system. So now I'm going to trace over the right or left half of the system. Actually, let's trace over the left. This is the environment, what I call the environment. Of course, that dichotomy is arbitrary, which side we call the environment, which the system, since it's the same, they're really the same in this problem. So now I'm left with this row, which is a 16 by 16 matrix, which I can diagonalize. And the sum of these eigenvalues are going to be equal to 1, because these wave functions are normalized. They have unit norm. So all the eigenvalues are real and positive, and they sum up to be 1. So I'll view them as probabilities. And I'll take the eigenvectors that correspond to the 8 largest eigenvalues and use those to project out the what I'll call the 8 most important states of the system. I'm throwing away the other 8. Remember, I was going from 8 to 16, but I ran out of computer memory, so I wanted to drop back to 8. So
I'm confused. Is it a diagonal somewhere or is it a diagonal?
Well, these are usually real, so, but you're right.
The wave functions are real.
Why is that?
It's a spin system?
For most of the systems we look at, the Hamiltonian is real, but I'm going to assume violate that. So you're right, but that should be psi star psi. And so this is just a systematic way for truncating the Hilbert space. I'm throwing away the eigenvectors corresponding to the 8 lowest eigenvalues. All right, so I have this whole subspace here is spanned by 16 basis vectors, and I'm throwing away what I'm calling the 8 least important ones.
I'm just confused what psi is. Sorry, that's a density matrix itself or not?
Psi is just the ground state. Let's, each psi equals of the whole chain.
So I'm trying to label what?
Sorry.
So I diagonalized the 8 site system, which had a Hilbert space of 256. And so to label that ground state or any state in that it has 256 possibilities. So I'm cutting it up into indices that describe the 16 left states and the 16 right states. Now I take that ground state and form the this reduced density matrix where I've only traced over half of the degrees of freedom of the system, the environment degrees. And that's basically what it's telling me is the probability when I look from the system side of looking at the environment side, which are the most probable states that might arise in the many-body wave function. So this is the key step where I'm making an approximation by throwing away some of the Hilbert space. Now, of course, I can include up to the limits of the machine, I can hold on, I can retain the whole Hilbert space until the chain grows out rather far. For example, in the case of the spin-on-half system, we often would go out to 16 sites before any truncation begins, because if I have sufficient memory, I might as well just keep on adding these sites into this block, making it bigger, and then only at some point when this exponentially growing Hilbert space gets unmanageably large, start throwing away chunks of it. And so since it's systematic, I can check that I get convergence as I increase m.
You keep the D separate because in the end you want to estimate the DD correlator. Is that the ideal? You want to see what the
correlator
is? I mean, the finite size dependence on this DD correlator is.
Right, yeah.
But wouldn't you say that as you grow the size of the chain, there are errors which become larger and larger the size? So each step you're thrown out.
Yeah, at some point it will break down. But we'll be able to see that because the breakdown will occur later and later as we retain more and more states in the Hilbert space. And usually it's pretty evident when that breakdown occurs. We're seeing nice power law scaling out to 1,000 sites, and then it starts diverging from it. And you double the size of them, and you can go out to 10,000 sites.
Is there any system where this can be done exactly?
It's exact for this, in context of the spin system, it's exact for these valence bond solids, the so-called AKLT states, Kennedy-Kasaki states. Since it's basically a variational wave function for certain classes of Hamiltonians, you can write down the exact wave function, and this just iterates and fills it out.
It's what about a higher dimensional AKLT model?
No, I'm not sure about that. I mean, the generalization of this algorithm to higher dimensions is very difficult because it really relies on the fact that we only make contact between the environment and the system at one point. So when you have, when you're studying the problems that like Steve White has been studying, it's much more difficult since the number of connections are so much greater. So that's a good question. This is very precise. For the spin and half system, I can get the ground state energy to 10-digit accuracy on running on a ordinary PC. So that's because the dimension D is just 2. As D increases, it becomes harder and harder.
How far do you how big do you have to make that?
In that case, I go out to about 1,000, and then I extrapolate to the thermodynamic limit.
Is it obvious which basis is optimal for this matter?
For the starting basis?
Yeah.
But it doesn't really matter, I think. This system will choose the optimal basis in the blocks. And I always work in the basis where the spins are up and down in the z direction. But I've looked at other possibilities. It doesn't seem to matter.
In this method, is Haldane's theorem sort of becomes obvious about the integer or half-integer spin?
No, I mean, numerically, as you'll see, it will be obvious, but I don't think it analytically necessarily sheds any light on it. Any other questions on this? All right, let me show you some results from the spin one half chain, and maybe quickly on the spin one. So this is the spin one half system. With varying degrees of anisotropy in the z direction. We know that as gamma here, the zz coupling increases from 0 to 1, we have a sequence of critical theories of a continuously varying exponent. But as gamma goes past 1, then we go into the Ising universality class. So what this is looking at is the induced magnetization in the center of the chain as the chain gets larger and larger. And you can see we have beautiful power law scaling, and the slope is these points here plotted against the exact value from bosonization. And we typically get a percent accuracy in that critical exponent. But as soon as we go to the Ising universality class, then we get exponential decay of this induced magnetization. Since you asked about the Haldane system, let me show you the results for the spin one chain. Has a nice phase diagram. For the pure bilinear interaction, just S dot S, then we're in this gapped Haldane phase. Here's this exact valence bond solid that you were asking about, David. This is the one where the DMRG becomes exact. So what I'm drawing here, this is, represents an atom with two electrons that are in a triplet state, and I'm this rectangle indicates that I formed a singlet bond between electrons in neighboring atoms. So this massive Haldane phase is separated from a dimerized phase where the singlet correlations are concentrated on alternating bonds by a critical point that's described by Wessolino-Witten model. And you can see clearly the phase transition between those. We look at the induced magnetization. It decays exponentially in the two massive phases, the dimerized phase and the Haldane gap phase, whereas at the critical point, it decays with a power law. If we look at the dimerization, then in the dimerized phase, the dimerization induced by the open boundary conditions goes to a non-zero final value, as you would expect, because there's truly long-range order in the dimers. Otherwise, it decays power law at the critical point or exponentially in the Haldane phase, which has no broken symmetries. Okay, so let me just give you one final illustration of this before we move to the TJ ladder. Let's look at the, this, go back to the spin one half system, but now slightly on the Ising side of things, because what I want to probe is how well am I able to ascertain whether there's long range order in this system. So this is looking at the spin moment at the center of the chain, where I've applied a field at the ends of the chain. In one case, a very strong field, that's this solid line, and in these other cases, a very weak field, h of 10 to the minus 4, in units where j equals 1. And I've looked at a severe truncation of the Hilbert space in these cases, except in this final case where I've kept 128 states in the final block. So in this case, the system's exact out to 16 sites or something like that. So you can see that if I apply a very strong magnetic field at the chain, ends of the chain, the magnetization decays and then reaches a plateau, asymptotes out to a constant value.
This is opposite magnetic field.
Right, this is in that anti-ferromagnetic arrangement. The value is less than 0.5 because we have strong quantum fluctuations. If gamma were equal to a million, we'd be just looking at basically the pure Ising model, and so the spin moment would be a half. If we instead put a very weak field on, then the magnetic moment increases as we go out, and it will eventually reach the same final value. This green line here is for a fairly large truncation. It's very severe. And so the asymptotic value is slightly less than basically the exact value, which would be down here. And you can see how these systems asymptote to different final values. So this is a nice way to probe whether there's any Ising order in the system. And that's the technique I'm going to apply now to the TJ ladder to see whether there really are any staggered currents in the system. So how do we do the DMRG method for our ladders? Well, now I'm just going to look at ladders that are consist of two chains that are coupled together, since that's the simplest possible system that could support this type of Ising order that has these plaquettes here. So I'm going to group two sites on a rung together into, I'll call that a single site in my DMRG method. It's going to have a dimension of 3 times 3 or 9, because we have spin up, spin down, or a hole on each of those two sites. So right away, you can see this is going to be a more difficult problem than the spin chain problem, because the Hilbert space is quite a bit larger. And now, instead of applying a magnetic field to the ends of the chain, what I'm going to do is I'm going to apply some source current terms that try to force an electrical current to flow at the ends of these chains. And I can consider both a antiferromagnetic arrangement, this would be the one that would be favored by the mean field theory with these circulations going in antiferromagnetic directions, versus a ferromagnetic arrangement where by symmetry, right at the center, there will be zero circulation. So let's warm up and apply this just to the tight binding, free tight binding model. What we expect there is to get power law scaling, power law decay, because we just have a free gapless system. And indeed, that's the case. This is at a filling fraction corresponding to about 0.2 electrons per site. And this order parameter here is basically just the magnitude of the currents in the center of the chain. And you can see that there's a power law decay. Just for comparison, I've shown you two different points for slightly different Hilbert space sizes. The M=64 one is more, well, it's in fact it's exotic up here for a chain size of just 8. There's a little bit of irregularities here because as I'm working at a constant chemical potential, so as I grow the chain, the total number of electrons in the system makes discontinuous jumps as the chain grows up until it approaches some constant fraction. Okay, so that makes sense. Now let's look at the TJ ladder at a quarter filling. So here the average occupancy per site is a half. Average electron occupancy per site is a half. And I'm looking at fairly reasonable parameters, J over T of 0.3. And it turns out a chemical potential of 0 corresponds to this half filling. And in this case, we find an exponential decay in this current. As we grow the system, the currents in the center drop rapidly to zero. Basically, the currents are short-circuited by the easy motion of the holes at the edges of the chain. And this is what's expected in the C1S0 phase that Leon and Matthew named. This is the phase for this model, which have one gapless charge mode and zero gapless spin modes. If you bosonize the current operator, you find that it involves exponentials of the spin field, which is gapped, so you get exponential decay. So that was all pretty standard. Now the surprise came was when I looked at the case of a filling fraction of 0.2. Is there a very different behavior occurs?
Can you specify which way the filling implied? Was this a staggered case?
These are all staggered. In the case of the non-staggered, it decays very rapidly in all cases.
You say this orbital current when bosonized is given by the spin excitation current?
It's given by the exponential of
a bunch of spin fields.
Spin field and charge fields, yeah. Since the spin fields, though, are all gapped, then you expect that the current correlation functions will decay.
Should that be obvious to you that current is given by spin fields?
It's strange to you because it's the same.
Yeah.
But the same thing is true for the pair field.
If you think about abelian bosonization, the field for, say, the boson corresponding to up electrons would be a linear combination of the charge boson and the spin boson. Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing that would enter into the current operator. All right, so in this case, now I've made the system less conducting because I've reduced the hole fraction to just 0.2. And I'm, again, looking at the response of the current in the interior of the chain as I grow it with this very weak applied current forcing term at the chain ends. And you can see some oscillatory behavior, but notice that that's not on an exponential plot anymore. And the contrast with the tight binding or the TJ ladder at a quarter filling becomes clear if I put them on the same plot. So what it looks like to me is a possible tendency towards long-range order. I haven't gone out to a long enough chain yet to see how this is going to trend, but it seems basically flat, whereas everything else is decaying quite rapidly on that same length scale. So I would say the conclusion of this is that in agreement with what Patrick Lee has been arguing and also what was shown in this preprint, which is the result of an exact diagonalization of a 32-site square lattice cluster with two holes that seem to indicate strong current-current correlations, that there is at the very least a strong correlation between the current operators in the system, and possibly it is going towards a long-range order. It's just a staggered T-breaking arrangement. The only way to answer that for certain is to go out to larger chains and to make a systematic study of the effect of the truncation of the Hilbert space on this result. The currents, if they're there, are quite small. So looking at just the current-current correlation function might be deceptive. The currents tend to be on the order of 10 to the minus 3, if I assume that this is going to go to a flat, asymptoting roughly to a flat line. And so the current-current correlation function would be 10 to the minus 6. That's something that people would normally just ignore and say, yes, it's gone to zero. So one would have to be very careful in looking at the current-current correlation function to decide whether the long-range order has really been destroyed or not.
I think minus three compared to what? What's the natural?
One, basically, yeah.
The current would be one. What's the flux here?
Well, the flux is very small. So I haven't computed the actual expectation value of the flux operator since it involves a large number of currents, products of currents, but it would be smaller. It's smaller, it seems, than the mean field description would have given you. So the currents are smaller by at least a factor of 10 from the mean field theory. So it might be one of these phases that, if it exists, would be very hard to see in nature because the currents would be very small. And so just try to see them directly. It was very difficult even at the mean field level to argue that one could see them with neutrons. They were corresponding to magnetic moments of about a tenth of a Bohr magneton.
But you're up at 20% filling. Right. Supposedly all these mean field calculations, right, by the time you get up to those fillings in 2D labs, right, the flux phase correlations seem to be gone, right?
In the mean field calculations, yes. I'm not sure where the exact boundary is. We know at 0.5 it's going away rapidly. It could be that on the ladder you can go, because of the geometric frustration, the fact that the currents can't leak away in all directions, that it the flux phase persists until somewhat larger doping. I'm seeing the same thing at a filling fraction of 0.1 though.
The same value or magnitude of it.
Roughly, yeah. I've only looked at two values so far. These are computationally difficult problems, so I've looked at 0.1 and 0.2. And roughly the same values, yeah. I don't have the 0.1 value.
Isn't it worrisome?
That it takes on the same value. Well, it's the same value within a factor of 2 or so. Yeah, not exactly the same value. What is most important is that like the x equals 2 data, it's showing the same sort of behavior, very qualitatively different than at larger filling fractions. The technical problem with this calculation is that, well, first of all, in a huge Hilbert space, this was done with, as I said, d equals 9 and m equals 128. That means that I'm diagonalizing a million by a million matrix, which isn't so bad. I'm used to doing that, but it's a complex matrix, and I haven't found making the wave function complex really increases the amount of numerical labor greatly, and also the efficiency of the algorithm for diagonalizing this thing seems to be affected. So that's to improve the efficiency of this the code is the next thing that needs to be done.
Is the matrix very sparse? Or?
Yes. Yeah. I never have to store the whole thing. It's almost all the matrix elements are zero.
So there are a lot of special techniques for.
Yes. Right. Right. I mean, if it were sparse, it would be hopeless because I could never store a matrix that's a million by a million on my computer.
So everything else. Do you have any information about how many gammas degrees of freedom you have? What is the charge load?
I have to look at that. No. What I've mainly been focusing on is making sure that this one result is correct. That I look at, for example, various cross checks, like current is conserved at vertices. So check that. I check that the spin moment is zero, basically, within numerical noise. Yes. and various other things like that. But I need to, I mean, if this holds up, certainly one would need to re-examine the low energy expectations, since it would, this is definitely different than the C1S0 case. So what is it? That's
a good question. Can you make a comment on the spin-tail separation?
No. I would take the exact reverse point of view of central and say it's the order that matters, not the speed charge.
Can you say something about the relation of these results to the results of White and Scalapino, where they find the strike correlation on similar systems?
They're looking at wider ladders. The ones you showed at the conference were 6x8, for example. So for the smaller systems, they tend not to strike.
Could the two orders coexist?
I don't see why not. Yeah, I think it could. Yeah. Now they've looked at this, the current correlation function, a little bit, and they find that it decays rapidly, but it decays to a value of like 10⁻⁶. So that's not inconsistent with the sort of precise currents that I have here. This is actually, this numerical value here is the sum of a current going around a placket minus the sum on the neighboring placket. So it's if you divide this by about 8, that gives you the size of the current on any given link. So it's consistent, I think, so far with other DMRV results. But it needs to be looked at more closely.
And how sensitive are the results to the bumping conditions?
If I increase the, well, I've only looked at open boundary conditions. I hope I've shown you from my work on the spin chains, we have a reasonable expectation that that works pretty well. If I increase the, if I try to drive a lot of the current at the ends, then I get a decrease in this current as it grows. But it's too soon now to know whether it asymptotes to the same value, as we saw in the case of the XYZ model, where we could see a convergence starting from very weak applied fields or strong applied fields, we converge to the same point in thermodynamics.
This long-range current correlation function without even surprising at all, even in the ordinary superconductor, the current correlation function is long-range.
Yes, but in this case,
how do we distinguish the two?
Right. In one dimension, we can't have true long-range superconducting order.
Actually, let's talk back into this numerical calculation Patrick keeps on referring to.
Uh-huh.
That's a 2D calculation, right?
That's right, yeah.
So I would claim that if I have a system that has superconducting correlation, right, we know that the Meissner effect is the same as having a long-range transverse current correlation.
Mm-hmm.
So why is this anything special?
Well, Patrick would say, I guess he would say it isn't so special. I mean, you can start, he also has a variational calculation where he starts from a D-wave ordered system and does a Gutzwiller projection and finds that there are long-range current correlations.
But the issue on the table is whether these numerical experiment signals a new phase or not.
Right, well,
I would say,
in one dimension on this ladder, I think that's the beauty of the ladder, is that there is no possibility for long-range superconducting order, because that breaks a continuous symmetry. It could be quasi-long-range order, and so if I find that this really is true long-range order, that is of an Ising type, and that's could not be explained by superconducting quasi-long-range order.
I just want to bring a bigger issue to the table,
right? Yes.
So,
right.
Looking at these numerical experiments, what should we say?
Well, okay, I agree. I agree with your observation about the two-dimensional problem, that
right.
That makes it a little bit murkier.
But if the current is staggered.
Well, if I can have a mixed anti-ferromagnetic and superconducting state, that will naturally be staggered. And this system only has two holes. It's
right.
Basically, it has anti-ferromagnetism.
Yeah, that's why I think the TJ ladder is a better place to start. I think we'll be able to make a definitive statement about that soon. And to my surprise, the preliminary results are surprisingly strong. So, you know, if we say we decide the TJ ladder, it does have true time reversal break and true long range order, then I think that then we have to go back and look at the two-dimensional system more carefully, but that's going to be a much more difficult problem.
Are there attempts to calculate 0.01 analytically?
Well, the mean field theory,
you say it gives a much smaller flux.
The mean field theory gives larger currents and larger fluxes than
seem to be way off.
That isn't so surprising because the mean field theory does such a bad job of treating the infinite U constraint that you might, there's a lot of blocking going along. Right. It's almost like one of those games where you have to move a piece
out of the way.
Right. So I'm not so surprised that numerically the value is much smaller, but I don't know of any other analytical treatments that try to do this.
So doesn't this say that it's very bad to take the TJ model and do slave boson gauge theory and all these things that people do?
Well, that's what we did, slave boson theory, and we found a T-breaking phase, so if it really exists, we'd be happy.
Okay. What's the sign of the effect that he gives on the 32 side lattice? Is it comparable?
Okay, the issue is somewhat murky because when he looks at current-current correlations, he finds the stagger pattern that the current drops off fairly rapidly. But then he says that the reason that it falls off rapidly is that the holes want to stick together. So then he looks instead at a different order parameter, which basically is the current operator divided by the mobile hole density. So if that thing it shows long-range order, then you're done. You've proven that there's a T-break. And in that case, it shows you could believe that it's going to an ordered state. But since there's only two holes, it's going to be difficult. So he's somewhat non-committal about that point. Okay, thanks.